The weather down here had three main settings: rain, pre-downpour, and post-downpour, with occasional brief periods of blue sky. God, she missed Zalem. She could not forgive Dyson for this, and she never would. He had been the one who bowed his head and accepted Nova's judgment, delivered by bureaucrats without a fight. He had built the stupid pod so they could land in the trash heap as if they belonged there. He had insisted they open the clinic and help those who were even worse off than themselves, as if there really was anyone worse off. No one else in this godforsaken town had lost as much as they had. But did Dyson even try to get any of it back? Of course not. He was too busy being Saint Dyson, ministering to the so-called less fortunate. Looking back on it now, she wasn't sure how much longer she'd have been able to stand being under the same roof with him anyway. He'd seemed content to go on living in a wasteland, having nothing, being nothing, doing nothing. Well, nothing that really mattered, even though he knew she was unhappy. He'd probably thought he was being patient. In truth, he didn't know the difference between patience and apathy. At least his famous insomnia had allowed her to rest undisturbed. They worked so hard all the time, she was too tired, either to be intimate or to explain why she didn't want to be. For the first time in her life, she'd been glad of his sleeplessness. And then their daughter. Chiden had taken to blanking the whole thing out. It was the worst thing that could ever happen to a parent, and she avoided reliving it. When her daughter's life had ended, her life as a mother and wife had ended too. Yet, she had gone on living. But not with Ido. Not in the home they'd shared with their daughter. Not in the clinic where the girl had scooted around helping them, laying out clean instruments and sterilizing used ones and chattering to the patients in the waiting room. Not in the place where Dyson had put all those hollows, with them looking like they really were a happy family. They were so absurd and unacceptable, those hollows, with their daughter smiling because she didn't know any better and Ido grinning like the fool he was. Ido had even made her look happy in some of them, as if she weren't revolted by the very air she was forced to breathe, as if she hadn't hated the dirt that soiled her shoes, her clothes, her life. Looking at those hollows, anyone would have thought they were a happy little ground-level family. Not hardly. Not even close. The one hollow that irked her most of all was the one Ido had smuggled out of Zalem. It was a close-up of the three of them, showing nothing that would reveal anything about the floating city. Well, unless you counted the fact that all three of them were clean, well-dressed, and obviously better off than they could ever be on the ground. She hated that one most of all because she didn't look happy enough for it to have been taken in Zalem. That woman in the hollow, with her daughter on her lap and her husband's arm around her, that woman was stupid and clueless and vacant. She didn't know anything bad could ever happen to her, even though the toddler on her lap was obviously too thin and pale to be normal. That woman had been too obtuse to know misfortune when she was actually holding it in her arms, and Ido, the son of a bitch, wasn't smiling as broadly as in a lot of the hollows taken in Iron City. He didn't look sad, just a bit thoughtful, like he didn't have brains enough to know that he was in the best possible place and he should appreciate it. Ido probably hadn't learned his lesson either. For all she knew, he was grinning like a damn fool right now, as if there really were something in this ugly, dirty world to be happy about. Chapter 5. The bruises on Hugo's face had faded enough to be practically unnoticeable. People no longer winced when they looked at him or asked him if he'd taken the license number of the ass-kicking machine that hit him. He still hadn't told his crew what had happened, not even Tanji and Koyomi. Tanji would have been all for getting everyone together for some payback, not caring how much bigger those guys were. That was Tanji all over. Tanji had been on the street longer than Hugo or anyone else in the crew, and he didn't back down from anything or anyone. He didn't go around looking for fights, but he wasn't afraid to square off against someone if he had to. Most of the time he came out on top, but even when he didn't, his opponents always knew they'd been in a fight. Tanji had taught him a few moves, good for both motorball scrimmages and self-defense. Hugo's preferred strategy for either was simply to be faster than everyone else, but that only worked if you remembered to stay alert, especially on someone else's turf. So now here he was, back in Southtown a week and a half later, staying very, very alert as he stalked the guys who had handed his ass to him and walked off with his mother's bracelet. At the moment, he was parked at the mouth of an alley, watching the crew hang out in the southy version of the market. It made him glad he lived in Midtown. The market wasn't really small, but everyone was squashed together with the vendors practically on top of each other, like Southtown wouldn't give them any more space than was absolutely necessary, and they were lucky to get that much. The forced togetherness didn't bring out the best in anyone's disposition. The food area didn't have as many different kinds of foods. The falafel looked good, but the woman behind the counter never stopped yelling at the kid working prep for her. Worst of all, in Hugo's opinion, there weren't any buskers, which might have made the general atmosphere a bit less grim and prickly and generally unpleasant. Or not, Hugo thought, watching one of his attackers harass a woman who'd had the poor judgment to get within arm's reach of him while searching for a place to sit down and eat the sandwich she'd just bought. The other guys jeered and hooted as she slapped his hands away. She left the market altogether, ignoring the calls and kissing noises. As she passed Hugo, she gave him a dirty look. He didn't blame her. She was around 30, a bit plump, dressed in a factory jumpsuit, just coming off the early bird shift at the nearby distribution center, packing shipments for Zalem, and she couldn't even eat a sandwich in peace. She had cyborg legs, Hugo recognized the gait. Everyone with cyborg legs attached to their torso walked the same way. Like his father, but only until he'd replaced more of his body. Then he'd walked like all the other machines. The woman could have kicked her harasser into a pulp with her cyborg legs. She could have stomped the whole crew, and everyone in the market would have cheered her on like a motorball hero. Didn't she know what she could do? Or was she too afraid of payback? The strong didn't just prey on the weak, Hugo thought. They made sure no one knew their own strength, too. "Not me, you assholes," he told them silently. "You might get a piece of everyone else, but you won't get me. Not again." Two guys Hugo didn't recognize joined them. They were just as big, possibly a little older than their fearless leader. Or maybe they just had more mileage. They had more scars, and one of them had a mouthful of crooked broken teeth. Hugo was surprised to find he actually felt a little sorry for them. Sad bastards. They had nothing going for them but following a bully. Tanji would have told him he was stupid for feeling sorry for a couple of meatbags who would have joined in stomping him if they'd been there. The crew ambled out of the market, heading farther south. Hugo paced them on a parallel street a block away. Even at that distance, he was taking a chance. He knew what Tanji would have said. "Are you crazy, or do you just have a death wish? What do I tell Vector if they beat you again? You can't help it. You're addicted to tough love?" The Tanji in his head was as big a pain in the ass as the real one, Hugo thought, ruefully. He was also right. If Vector knew he was doing exactly what he'd been told not to, he'd kick the whole crew to the curb, even though they'd delivered two orders on time since the late one. Tanji might even go looking for another crew and take the others with him, leaving Hugo with no one to watch his back. People who tried to make it alone, without a crew or family or anybody to care what happened to them, didn't last long. The thing was, Tanji and Koyomi and the others, they all still had family. Even if they didn't live with them, they had blood relatives, parents or aunts and uncles, cousins. Koyomi had so many cousins, it seemed like half of Iron City was related to her. People with family didn't know what it was like to be related to no one, and they didn't know what it was like to have the only thing you could remember your mother by taken from you like it was nothing. Like you were nothing. Hell, Hugo didn't even know where his parents were really from. They'd never talked about their families except to say they were all dead. Now that they were gone too, Hugo might have just sprung up out of the ground or dropped out of the sky from nowhere. Or from Zalem? Hugo looked up longingly at the city floating overhead. If only. The Southtown crew wandered through the neighborhoods in no particular hurry, taking a route that arced west as well as south, and all they did was hassle and harass everyone they met, shaking them down for money and anything else that caught their eye. It was a protection racket, Hugo realized. Pay up and we won't kick your ass. Some people gave them credits without being asked. Sometimes the crew would leave them alone. More often, they'd hassle them for more money. They collected from a few businesses, too, mostly small grocers or cafes or sad little hardware stores or junk shops. Why did those people go along with it? Hugo wondered. Why didn't anyone do something or ask someone for help? Like who? A hunter warrior? Hunter warriors only went after someone if there was a price on their head. The factory wouldn't bother putting a marker on these guys. They were too penny-ante. No marker, no bounty. No bounty, not a bounty hunter's problem. The crew kept moving until they came to an open-air cafe 4 or 5 blocks west of the market where Hugo had first picked up their trail. They went in and commandeered the place, driving out the other customers while getting grabby with the waitresses. They were so full of themselves, Hugo thought he could have ridden his gyro right through the center of the cafe without any of them noticing, or at least not right away. Hugo parked his gyro around the side of the building, put his hood up, and sat on the curb in front to watch them surreptitiously. The leader was really stuck on himself. He had gold tips in his hair now, and there was more to the design tattooed on the right side of his neck. And, Hugo saw finally, he was wearing the bracelet. At first he was surprised. He'd have thought the guy would give it to a girlfriend or sell it. Nope, not this guy. It was all for him, everything they did, the whole operation. He was just going to keep doing whatever he wanted until somebody stopped him. The guy probably couldn't even imagine that happening. He was like a robot, not even a cyborg. He was a meat robot, and all he did was all he knew how to do. Hugo decided he'd had enough. Of the crew, of Southtown, of Iron City for that matter, and of everyone who just stood by and let any kind of shit happen, whether they were people who got victimized on the street, or factory slaves who replaced their bodies piece by piece so they could die with almost nothing left that made them human. Chapter 6
I wanted to do this months ago, Vector said, sitting across from her at the small table set up in his office, which was ridiculously large and luxurious to the point of vulgar. But I thought it would be unseemly, uncouth, as if my interest in you were less than worthy.
Chiden didn't quite smile at him over the top of her wine glass. He was talking the way he thought people talked in Zalem. wanting her to believe she wasn't the only highly evolved intellect marooned in the dirt with lower forms of life. He was trying to make the whole evening as much like Zalim as possible. The brilliant white tablecloth, the wine obviously pilfered from a shipment meant for the flying city. It made her glad she was wearing the cream-colored tunic and trousers she'd had on the day they had been exiled. They were the only things she had from her lost life, and she hadn't worn them again until tonight. Vector knew her clothes were from Zalim, and he couldn't take his eyes off them, his gaze running over her arms, her shoulders, her chest, with an eagerness and avidity that veered between wonder and lust. "I've worked on your motorball players for years." Chiden took a sip of wine, refusing to let herself enjoy it. She had to keep her wits about her. She was a sheep eating dinner with a wolf posing as a shepherd. She couldn't let her guard down for a moment. "In that time, you've always treated me with respect. I have no reason to expect anything else." "Expect respect. Expect respect." The words echoed in her mind nonsensically, as if she were already drunk.
"You and your husband were a package deal," Vector said. "Two highly skilled cybersurgeons, turning my paladins into winners while funding your work with the less fortunate, of which there's no shortage in Iron City. I so admired what you two were doing that I could never bring myself to take offense at Ido's, lack of warmth, call it. I put it down to overwork."
"That's very kind of you," Chiden said, looking into his eyes. She could do sincere. Two flunkies in formal wear came in with appetizers, baked camembert, or what passed for it in Iron City, with small round pieces of garlic toast. Chiden noticed Vector waited a fraction of a second to see what she did, then copied her exactly. The observe and mimic strategy was probably how he'd survived for so long.
"You've always been more approachable," Vector told her. "No matter how hard you've been working, you remain even-tempered. I put that down to your innate character."
"That's very kind of you," Chiden said again, letting herself smile. "But I think it only means you weren't around when I bit someone's head off." Vector chuckled.
"If you bit anyone's head off, I'm sure they had it coming. Actually, I'd wanted to invite both you and Ido to dinner to show my appreciation and my admiration. But you were both so busy, working so hard all the time. If you weren't at the track, you were at the clinic. There never seemed to be any time in your schedule to relax. Although I wasn't so sure how relaxing it would be for you to have dinner with the boss." He paused, looking at her expectantly.
"Well, that really was all Ido and I did together," Chiden said. "Work, I mean. At the clinic, at the track, Ido never learned how to shut it off. In all the time I knew him, I don't think he ever slept more than 4 hours in a night, and usually not that much. I'd wake up and find him at his workbench, fiddling with a circuit or a chip."
"Really?" Vector was gazing at her more intently now. "What kind?"
Chiden was about to tell him about the integration chip that had been Ido's obsession when the flunkies came back for the empty dishes. Vector raised a subtle finger and she nodded to show she understood. She'd finished the camembert without even noticing. It had been a long time since she'd eaten anything that good.
"Sorry," he said when the flunkies were gone. "I do trust my staff, but I also do my best not to add to their burden of discretion. They work hard enough as it is."
If Vector had ever cared how hard his employees worked,
It hadn't been in this lifetime, Chiden thought.
As I've pointed out already, you're very kind, she said. Two different men brought in the main course, filet mignon for her and a very large, very bloody prime rib for him, accompanied by baked potatoes with sour cream and butter and green beans. The butter was too yellow, and the green beans looked like they might glow in the dark. Vector had added color to his filched foodstuffs to match his idea of how fancy food would look in Zalem. Chiden found it both absurd and pathetic.
"Is that all right?" Vector asked, nodding at her steak. "I thought it was something you would like, unless you'd rather have the prime rib."
He put on a mildly concerned expression.
"Or have I guessed wrong altogether, and you're a vegetarian?"
"I'm most definitely not a vegetarian, and filet mignon is exactly right," she assured him. "The name means dainty filet, and it comes from the tenderloin area on either side of a beef animal's spine. It's cut from the smaller end, where the lesser-used muscles are located, which is why it's so tender." She smiled at the bodyguards as they arranged the other dishes on the table for them. They were also in formal wear. It made her wonder how he'd found suits to fit them with their enhancements. Lots of alterations, she supposed, unless he'd actually had them made. If so, he'd gone to a great deal of trouble and expense for her. What did he want, besides the obvious? Was it real, and if so, could she actually give it to him? The term filet mignon was first used in a story by some writer way back in the early 20th century, Chiden added as the bodyguards marched out of the room, but the story title and the author's name escaped me.
"Maybe more wine will help," Vector said, giving her a refill she didn't actually need.
They were drinking from crystal wine goblets Vector claimed he'd found in a stash hidden in the factory before the war 3 centuries ago. He made the same claim about a lot of things, but he might have been telling the truth about these. Chiden forced her wandering mind back to the situation at hand. "I hope hearing about my steak didn't overburden your men," Chiden said.
"It's probably the most education they've had for," Vector made a face of mock concentration, "ever. I had no idea you were so knowledgeable about cuts of beef."
"Well, I am a surgeon," she said. Vector surprised her by throwing back his head and roaring laughter at the skylight above them.
"That one hit me square on the funny bone," he said when he wound down.
Chiden smiled. She was tempted to give him a lesson about the humorous and decided to save it in case he annoyed her. His cultured mask had begun to slip a little. He was starting to look at her the way he looked at his prime rib, and it wasn't just her clothes he was appreciating now. She had to admit she was surprised at how well the dinner had been prepared. If it wasn't as good as anything she had ever had in Zalem, it was close enough. Did Vector have an exiled chef chained to the wall in the kitchen? Maybe someone Nova had thrown over the side for burning his toast?
"This really is excellent," she told Vector. "My compliments to your chef."
He laughed again. "I'll pass your compliments along."
Then he sobered.
"I wanted so much to please you, to make everything perfect. You deserve the best of everything, the best food, the best clothes, and a palace to live in, rather than 3 run-down rooms with a view of nothing."
And he was just the man to give them to her, Chiden thought. The only man who could, anyway. She took a sip of wine, and Vector poured more into her glass as soon as she put it down again. Like magic, the bodyguards appeared with another bottle. They poured the last of the old bottle into Vector's glass, then opened the new one and added an inch to hers before they left.
"Please tell me you don't eat like this every night," Chidan said with a small laugh.
"No, I don't. I couldn't, even if I wanted to,"
Vector replied, sounding a bit wistful.
"I have so many responsibilities that I can seldom take this much time for a meal. Besides, I'd feel silly doing this alone."
He paused, staring at his wine glass with a thoughtful expression.
"As I get older, I find I'm becoming less and less content to be by myself. An active mind needs stimulating company. Someone to talk to. I'm starved for conversation that has nothing to do with business, motorball, or making sure everyone's doing their jobs right."
His gaze slid away from the glass to her.
"I can't even imagine what it's like for you."
Chidan tensed a little. If he started talking about her daughter, if he even said her name aloud, she would throw her wine in his face.
"As I said, I did want to reach out to you before now," he went on, "to let you know that I was thinking of you, that I felt for you after such a terrible tragedy."
Chidan kept her face neutral as her fingers tightened ever so slightly on the stem of her glass.
"When I found out you were alone, I wanted to reach out to you even more to say..."
His voice trailed off and he frowned.
"To be frank, I had no idea what to say to you. I still don't. What you've been through is completely outside my experience. I was afraid if I said the wrong thing to you, I might lose you as well as Ido. I didn't want that. At the same time, I didn't know if this was a permanent break, or if Ido might want to reconcile..."
"He won't," said Chidan. "Ido is where he wants to be, doing what he wants to do. As far as I know, anyway. We haven't spoken since I left."
"So you left him," Vector said.
He added more wine to her glass. She didn't remember drinking any, but apparently she had.
"I was afraid you were going to tell me he'd thrown you out. I might not have been able to stop myself from, talking to him about his bad manners, even if it's not my place."
"No, I left of my own free will," Chidan said, keeping her tone light. "Motorball gives me, what I need. Work I can throw myself into. It's been, well, practically a lifeline."
"I'm glad it's helped you."
Vector had on his compassionate face now.
"But if I'm honest, I've benefited greatly."
Pause.
"Which almost sounds as if I'm reaping rewards from your pain."
"Thanks for letting me know," Chidan told him silently, keeping her face neutral.
Spinning pain into gold was a succinct description of what Vector did for a living.
"Of course not," she said. "Last chance to run," said a little voice in her mind. "If you don't go now, you may never get out. If you do run, don't stop till you get to the clinic. Dyson will take you back like you were never gone, and you're still in your childbearing years."
Chidan killed the thought and shoved it away as hard as she could.
"Bring a child into this world? Down in the dirt? Doom an innocent soul to the tender mercies of Iron City? Watch a pure spirit become tainted with corruption? And for what? A no-hope future as either a factory slave at best or a hunter-warrior's bounty at worst? Had she lost her mind?"
Maybe. But she wasn't brain dead. She was going to stay right where she was, finish this incredible Zalim-worthy steak dinner, courtesy of the most powerful man at ground level, a man who was willing to go to a lot of trouble to keep her happy. Or at least keep some of her appetites satisfied, while satisfying his own, of course. But what the hell? It was more than she'd ever get anywhere else. "I'm afraid I'm full," she said, as she finished the last bite of her steak. "I've barely touched the baked potato, and it's awful to let it go to waste, but..."
"But nothing," Vector said, waving one hand, and for the first time, Chiden noticed his fingernails were manicured. "My chef is brilliant. Nothing will go to waste," he smiled. "Would you prefer to delay dessert and just have coffee for now?"
"You read my mind," Chiden said, reading his. She was tempted to ask what they'd be having for dessert, but she didn't think he'd get the joke. The coffee came in a silver service that made Chiden gape openly. The only other time she had seen something like this had been in the apartment of the man who had told her and Ido why they had to leave Zalim.
"I think I've impressed you," Vector said, studying her face. "Have I?" "Yes? Pardon me for feeling pleased with myself about that."
"I shouldn't be surprised at anything," Chiden said. "Not after that meal, anyway."
"Like the crystal wine glasses. I found it hidden away in the factory, stashed by someone before the war, but never retrieved for reasons that are only too easy to imagine." Vector's pleased expression had turned to smugness. Chiden supposed he'd never needed to know the difference between the two.
"I am impressed," she told him. "So little from before the war survived. It's amazing. A work of art."
"Then please allow me to give it to you as a gift," Vector said. "A work of art for a woman who is herself a work of art."
"You know, of course, that after tonight he will never talk to you like this again," said the voice in her mind. "This is just to get you into..." She shut the voice out. It wasn't telling her anything she didn't know.
As soon as they finished their coffee, he led her to his bedroom. There was no explanation, no suggestion. This was simply what came next on the schedule, and since she hadn't talked even vaguely about leaving, he'd assumed they had come to an understanding. His bed was enormous, about as large as the living room in the dump she called home, she thought. He took his time undressing her. He'd waited all night to get his hands on her clothes, and now the magic time had come. He rubbed the material between his fingers, marveling at the softness and the subtle glint from threads that were neither metallic nor cloth, but something else. She moved to undress him, but he told her to climb into bed and feel the sheets instead. The product of nanomachines that were his and his alone, he told her, unavailable even in Zalim. No one else had sheets that felt so good against bare skin. Then he had dessert. She had expected to be disappointed, and he delivered with no surprises. Vector knew what he liked, and he knew what a woman's body was supposed to like, or at least respond to. He handled her expertly. It was all so impersonal. She wondered whom he was really in bed with. Maybe a composite created from different experiences. And all without a word. He didn't speak to her at all. When she started to say something to him at the beginning, he had looked meaningfully into her eyes and pressed his finger to her lips. Hush. She had listened to the sound of his breathing and her own and the whisper of the sheets, and that was all. When he finally fell away from her, he looked pleased and gratified. Mission accomplished. If she had broken his concentration with pillow talk, it might have taken him forever to get himself back into the right frame of mind. The ceiling in his bedroom was high, not like the one in her miserable, cramped flat. Fortunately, she'd never have to go back there again. He'd send his flunkies to collect her things for her. She lived here now, in the penthouse atop the factory. Not really a palace, but as close as she'd ever get in this lifetime. And this was the best bed she would ever sleep in, with its miraculously soft sheets. He would dress her in handmade designer clothes, which she would wear even when she was working on his paladins at the motorball track. As long as she made champions for him, he would make sure she stayed shiny, elegant, and in good repair, just like everything else he owned. She was going to live better than she ever had since her expulsion from Zalem. The food would be great, too, just like the clothes and the sheets on the bed. And the sex would be sex. This man would never make love to her, but that didn't matter. She was pretty sure he'd never made love to anybody. Well, she hadn't come here for love or great sex, or even good sex. Vector had much more than that to offer. A man who wasn't afraid to skim from shipments intended for Zalem obviously knew the authorities were looking the other way, which meant he had some seriously important connections, the kind that might know how to get her out of the dirt, off the ground, and back up to where the air was clean and bright. Why else would the sex be so bad? Chapter 7. When the distinguished lady cybersurgeon finally dropped off, Vector got up and put on his silk pajamas and robe. The pajamas were adorned with alternating bands of silver. The robe was the color of excellent Shiraz. Someone had once told him they made him look like old-time royalty, the lord of the manor. Vector no longer remembered which of the various women who had passed through his bedroom had come up with that insightful description of his appearance. Memorability wasn't a trait he looked for in the women he invited into his bedroom. Chiren was the lone exception, and only because she was useful. Since the first moment he'd seen her, Vector had been curious as to what she was like in bed. As he became better acquainted with her, he formed his own ideas about it, and she hadn't surprised him. Had she been a very different person up there in Zalem, that Dyson Ido would fall in love with her? Or was he one of those sad fools who had a type? Maybe they were all the same up there, neurotic, pretentious, and unreachable. He wouldn't have been surprised. Vector took a few moments to de-opaque the window and look out at the night view of Iron City. Seeing it like this, he could almost forget it was really just a toilet for the aristocrats in the sky. Okay, that was a bit harsh. Trash can was more like it, or junkyard. He had come to this place very young, but even then he had wondered what kind of people built a city around a better city's rubbish. It hadn't taken him long to learn the answer. He was a quick study, and it was the same now as it had always been. People with the souls of jackals and hyenas. Carrion eaters that survive on some better, stronger animal's leavings. And what did that make him? He smiled. That was an easy one. "I'm the king, baby. I'm the Emperor, the Lord High Commander, and the jackals and hyenas worship me as their god. Anyone screws with me, I don't have to kill them. I have someone to do it for me, and I pick my teeth with their bones." There was only a partial view of Zalem from here, but it included the waste chute. Refuse poured out of it as he watched. "More riches for me. The Emperor acknowledges your tribute. Thank you, and good night." 3 centuries since the War of Whatever, and still no one knew much about the place. Well, almost no one. The one in his bed wasn't talking, but she didn't have to. Vector knew people, and he knew life, and he was pretty sure that things up there probably weren't a whole lot different than they were on the ground. The only difference was, up there, they had nicer things and no one went hungry unless they wanted to. In Vector's opinion, any place where people starved themselves in the midst of plenty was corrupt all the way through. Vector knew little about Zalem. Most of his contact came by hollow, from factory bureaucrats who looked too wispy to cast a shadow, although that may have been his screen. They called to tell him what Zalim wanted. More avocados, not so many grapefruit, larger cucumbers. But Vector knew damn well they weren't in charge. The first time he'd seen the man in charge was shortly after he'd taken over in Iron City, which the man in charge had helped him with. Even then, they hadn't had much contact, but he'd known the man had been watching him, and he liked what he saw. Vector hadn't merely known that, he'd felt it, especially after he'd consented to letting the factory install the identity chip. The chip saved a lot of time and trouble. It was like having a universal master key to all the locks that mattered. In some cases, literally. He no longer had to carry key cards or remember entry codes. But even better, the chip provided a connection between himself and the man in charge, whom he thought of as the Watcher, even after learning his name was Nova. The first time Vector had seen the Watcher on his screen had been on a conference call about quarterly production figures. The Watcher had been sitting silent, off to one side, but Vector had known who he was. It wasn't hard to guess why. He and the Watcher were two of a kind. He knew the Watcher had been around for a very long time, an impossibly long time, if the stories were true. Maybe he'd been waiting for someone like Vector, someone who saw things from the same angle, heard what he heard, and knew how the music was going to change, and knew what to do when it did. Although, to be honest, Vector thought the Watcher had it easier. When he gave an order, everybody up there gladly went along with it, so they could keep all their nice things. What had happened to the distinguished lady cybersurgeon in the bed behind him was their worst nightmare. Thinking about it that way, Vector could almost have felt sorry for them. But he'd never been able to muster up any pity for people who were happy to serve in heaven when it was so much better to rule in hell. He turned to look at the distinguished lady cybersurgeon. Correction, his distinguished lady cybersurgeon. She belonged to him now, just like the view, the penthouse, and anything else he cared to call his own. Iron City itself was, for all intents and purposes, his. From his penthouse atop the main factory building, he ran the show. Any show. Every show. All shows great and small, from motorball to marketplaces. Nothing happened without his say-so, and so it would continue. Because he knew how to keep things functioning. It was actually very simple down here in the dirt. Just enough bread and a plethora of circuses. Circuses made people forget they wanted more bread. Keep the circuses coming thick and fast, and after a while, people would choose circuses instead of bread. Bread was expensive, but you could make circuses out of anything. Even a pile of trash. It was well after 1 a.m. when the supervisor from the factory's Southtown distribution center called to say she had skimmed another load of plums from the fresh fruit bound for Zalim. She'd swapped them out for green apples and altered both the packing list and the requisition form so it would look like someone up there had a green apple habit. Concord grapes, however, still weren't available anywhere, and wouldn't be for another couple of months.
"So what's the problem now?" Vector demanded testily. "I thought you said they finally developed a strain that'll produce all year round."
"Yeah, they did," said the supervisor. She was a middle-aged woman named Frida, who was high up on his go-to list as someone who got results. She wasn't conventionally beautiful, but Vector had found her very attractive, so much so that he had nearly made the mistake of going to bed with her, which would have completely ruined her as an employee. "They got the grapes to grow just fine," Frida was saying, "but they can't get them to ripen faster without losing all the quality. I tasted the fast ones, and they taste like nothing. They don't even smell like Concord grapes. They smell like, well, nothing. Not even grass. So we gotta wait till they're ready."
And they call themselves scientists, Vector said, his voice dripping with contempt. Meanwhile, the gutless wonders in Zalim aren't complaining. How are any of them still alive?
Nobody told them to die, said Frida.
That jerked a surprised laugh out of Vector in spite of everything.
You're probably right, he said,
and told her to keep him posted before he hung up. God, why couldn't she have been a distinguished lady cybersurgeon, he thought, just as the phone rang again. This time it was Myrtle, one of the pit bosses at the Motorball Stadium. There had been no game tonight, just a practice session for the jobbers. Myrtle told him they had enough parts and equipment to cover everyone's repairs tonight, but only for tonight.
As of now, the cupboard's pretty much bare, Myrtle said.
She sounded tired, but she always did, even when she wasn't.
After tonight, we need a whole lot of inventory or we gotta figure out how to make servos from cardboard and spit, and we're all out of cardboard.
Vector groaned. Make a list, then copy it 24 times and hand it out to our best suppliers, including, what's his name, the kid with the crew that's always hanging around.
You mean Hugo? Myrtle said.
Don't ask me. I'm not your secretary, Vector snapped. Just get going on this. If we come up short, it's your head I'll be yelling for.
He managed not to crush his phone screen. Then he sat and glared at it.
Go ahead. Ring again, he muttered.
It did, making him jump. This time it was Gamut, calling from the Kansas bar with the news that one of Vector's paladins had busted up most of the furniture, then stormed out without paying his tab, leaving the owner close to apoplexy in the wreckage.
Who was it? Vector asked wearily.
Wheelstein,
Gamut told him.
He's a menace!
Yelled the owner in the background. Vector knew his voice. He'd heard it in the background of a lot of phone calls.
Tell the owner he's not one of mine anymore. I just cut him from the team, Vector said. Which means Wheelstein's responsible for his own expenses.
He listened as Gamut relayed the message to the owner.
Is he about to burst a blood vessel?
Vector asked Gamut in the ensuing silence.
Oh, I'd say about half a dozen, Gamut replied, making it sound as if he were talking about damage.
Gamut had a lot of cool. If only he didn't dress like he lived under the causeway.
All right, put him on.
A moment later, the bartender's strained voice said,
Hello?
As my associate just explained, Wheelstein is no longer one of mine, Vector said smoothly, which, I'm sorry to say, means he's uninsured.
He waited a beat to let the bar owner's blood pressure hit 300 over 200, then added,
However, as a goodwill gesture because so many of my guys drink there, send me the bill and I'll cover half of it.
The bar owner made a strangled noise that could have been yes. Gamut came back.
Anything else?
No, Vector said. Now get out of there before he tries to make you call back and ask for more.
He hung up and called the pit boss back to tell her to cut Wheelstein and backdate the paperwork by 24 hours.
Sure thing, boss, Myrtle said. What about all the stuff in his locker? Guy's like a hoarder.
Can you eat it? Vector asked.
Hell no!
Myrtle sounded incredulous now as well as tired.
Then whatever you do with stuff you can't eat, do that.
Oh!
Myrtle sounded a little sheepish.
Okay.
Vector hung up and made a note to pay only a fourth of whatever figure the bar owner sent him, which would be about half of the actual cost. Bar owners were always trying to bleed him. Next case. He sat at the desk and waited. A minute went by in silence, and then another. He checked the time. It was after 2:30. Stupid o'clock, sometimes known as suicide o'clock, when things usually went quiet and stayed that way until sometime between 5 and 5:30. Vector swiveled around in his chair and looked out of the big windows. They had the best view of Zalim.
When he first got the desk, he'd put it facing the windows, then realized it would put his back to both doors. It made him feel too vulnerable. By contrast, putting Zalim behind him felt like it was not only his, but it was backing him up as well, which, considering his arrangement with the factory, wasn't too far from the truth. While he and Chiden had been having dinner in here, she hadn't been able to go more than a minute without looking at the view, and he knew that it wasn't Iron City she'd been so captivated by. She obviously had no idea how much her longing showed. She was homesick. Poor thing. Who could have blamed her? Iron City was a hell of a comedown from what she was used to. He was going to have a hard time making her see that just because you lived at ground level didn't mean you were in the dirt. Handmade designer clothes, fancy food, and the penthouse would have turned any other woman's head, but Chiden was homesick. Of course, maybe he could use that to his advantage, he thought suddenly. If she thought he'd send her back to Zalim in exchange for making his paladins into champions and his champions into winners, that just might do the trick and put a little more hustle in her bustle. Or even a lot more. She wouldn't be the first person he'd promised to send to Zalim. He'd never have to deliver. He always found a way to show an eager would-be traveler how they'd failed to keep their part of the bargain, rendering the deal null and void. With Chiden, he wouldn't have to worry about that for a long time. Meanwhile, he could work the hell out of her, and she'd be only too glad to do it. He probably wouldn't even have to pay her, except in clothes and food and a place to live. Oh, and act like he cared just often enough to make her think he did. He could even say, "I love you," if he had to, although he doubted it would ever come to that. Chiden was so bitter and wrapped up in herself, she might not catch on for decades. Damn. How could someone so brilliant and intelligent be so blind and stupid? Maybe it was losing her kid that had ruined her. But that wasn't the whole story. If her daughter had still been alive, she'd have still been miserable because she wasn't in Zalim. And even if her daughter had been alive and she'd still been in Zalim, she'd have found something to be unhappy about. Maybe that was what Dyson Ido was for. Except things hadn't worked out that way. Which was his lucky break, Vector thought, smiling at Zalim's shadow in the night sky. High overhead, above the clouds, the man leaning on the railing at the very edge of Zalim smiled. He was enjoying the show.
Chapter 8 Ida hoped this would be one of those rare nights when he was tired enough to sleep. He'd kept the clinic open an extra 3 hours for everyone in need, triaging them into three categories: urgent, today for sure, and mañana. Chiden had done him no favors by leaving. She hadn't even offered to find someone to fill in for her. If he didn't get some help soon, he might have to put Hugo in a nurse's uniform. Although the little scoundrel hadn't been around since the night he'd limped in all beat to hell. After treating him, Ido had told him to come back the next day for a checkup, but he hadn't. Well, he was a kid. He'd probably been distracted by something shiny. Or maybe he'd annoyed somebody else and he'd got his ass kicked again. Ido hoped not, but he wouldn't have been surprised. Once his too-long day was over, he'd considered checking the scrapyard to see if Zalim had thrown out anything useful. But then he'd taken a quick look at his accounts, and his accounts said he needed to put in some time at his second job. The rocket hammer was in its case, ready for use. No matter how tired he was always careful about how he put it away, taking it apart, cleaning the components and inspecting them for cracks or worn places,
making sure the controls were stable and there was plenty of fuel to fire it up, ensuring none of the little vents were blocked so the power was there when he needed it most and he wasn't just holding a fancy stick in his hands. He closed the case, went to the bureau to get his gloves, and remembered he'd left them in his coat pockets. As he turned away, he caught sight of himself in the mirror.
Damn, he looked cold.
It was hard to believe the man he saw there was a doctor. He looked more like someone who killed people for money and never gave it a second thought. Not entirely true. He thought about everything he did. Then he put on the dark coat and the gloves, pulled his hat low, set his glasses for night vision, and wheeled the rocket hammer case into the elevator. He wouldn't be the only one out hunting. He never was. But there were plenty of marks to go around. He was lucky. He picked up two marks in a row, both highly rewarding. They put up a fight, but he'd got good at this. Using the rocket hammer, he bagged the first one in 10 minutes, and the second in 15, including the time it took to remove their heads. Both were wanted for home invasions in which a total of 5 people had been killed. Ido presented their heads at the factory redemption counter and came away with close to 50,000 credits for the night's work. That would keep the clinic open for another week, the good Lord willin', and the creek don't rise. Yeah, right. The good Lord was only willing to be absent these days, and it had been raining so much the creek had turned into a rushing river that was halfway up its banks. Any more rain, and there'd be flash flooding around the bridge again. Ido had sent a message to the factory telling them they had to do something about the drainage upstream in the eastern part of town. They'd paved over too much land, and it didn't allow adequate runoff. He'd have thought that in this climate, they'd know better. His answer had been a form email thanking him for his input. Did Iron City even have a civil engineer, he wondered. Ido came back from the factory redemption center bone-weary after fighting, hoping he'd used up enough energy to drop dead for a few hours. The second mark had given him a hard punch in the ribs, which was going to hurt more tomorrow. Ido didn't care. All he wanted was an intermission that would divide tonight from tomorrow, instead of it being all one long today. The spirit was willing, but the insomnia was stronger, and the flesh was collateral damage. Dr. Dyson Ido could heal everyone but himself. Not long after they'd opened the clinic together, Chidan had suggested he let her give him a mild sedative, and he had absolutely refused. A drug would only make him high, not sleepy. He'd be sleepless and stoned, and he'd like the stone feeling too much. Then he'd have a problem much worse than insomnia. Insomnia, for all its faults, was free. Chiren hadn't argued. She'd seen as many addicted ex-paladins as he had. They kept all the drugs that felt good locked up in the cellar safe and set an alarm that would notify both of them whenever it was opened. That way, neither of them could yield to temptation without the other knowing. Ido was sure Chiren didn't need the safeguard. Addiction was a loss of self-control. Chiren would never let that go. Not just for a cheap high, anyway. Ido had muted the alarm on his own phone, but never shut it off completely. It still sent messages to her phone whenever he opened the safe. Her phone rejected all of them. She'd probably thrown the phone away by now, or maybe she'd buried it in a drawer or a closet to keep the number because it was hers. Chiren had a strict policy. Whatever was hers stayed hers. Well, except him. He sometimes thought about actually calling her old number to see who, if anyone, would answer. He never did, though. There was an ever-so-slight chance that Vector would answer, and Ido didn't know what would happen if he heard that slick bastard's voice answer the number she'd had when they'd still been together. He might scream or tear out his hair, break down and cry. His head might even explode, or he might just hang up without speaking. But no matter what he did,
Vector would know that he'd got to him, and that was the last thing Ito wanted. Vector had come out on top, just like he always did. He could ride around in his limo and tell himself he was the king of the world in his factory penthouse, but he would never hear Ito say it.